In the name of Almighty God, I, John, Lord of Joinville, Seneschal of Champagne, do cause to be written that which I saw and heard during the space of 6 years that I was in the company of King Louis on the pilgrimage overseas, and after we returned. In the year 1241, the king held a great court at Saumur in Anjou. I was there, and can bear you witness that it was the finest that I ever saw. For there ate at the king's table beside him the Count of Poitiers, whom he had newly knighted on a St. John's Day, and in front of the king's table sat my lord the King of Navarre, in a coat and mantle of samite, richly adorned with belt and clasp of gold, and I was before him. The king had donned a coat of sky blue satin, and on his head a cotton bonnet, which became him very ill. And in all the other wings, and in the centre plot, there feasted a vast number of knights, more than I can tell. Many people say that they never saw before at any feast so many surcoats and other garments of cloth of gold as there were there, and that there must have been full 3,000 knights in the place. But it happened, by God's will, that a great sickness overtook the king, whereby he was brought so low, as he used to relate, that one of the ladies who were nursing him declared him to be dead, and was about to draw the sheet up over his face, but another lady, who was on the opposite side of the bed, would not permit it. And so when the king heard the two ladies disputing, our lord worked in him, and presently sent him health, for he had been voiceless and could not speak. He desired then that they would give him the cross, and they did so. When the queen, his mother, heard that his speech had returned to him, nothing could surpass her rejoicings. But when she learned that he had taken the cross, she made as great mourning as though he lay dead before her eyes. After the king had taken the cross, all three of the king's brothers took it, and many more besides. And so, at Easter, in the year of grace, which was just striking 1248, I summoned my liegemen and my vassals to Joinville. All that week we feasted and danced, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and on the Friday I said to them, "Sirs, I am going away overseas, and I know not whether I shall return. Now, therefore, come forward, and if I've done any of you a wrong, I will right it, and will redress in turn any grievances you may have against me or my servants." I put everything right with them as regards the public business of my estates. And so, I set out, with 9 other knights, myself the 10th. And in a little while, the wind had caught the sail and carried us beyond sight of land, and we saw nothing but water and sky. And every day, the wind carried us further away from the land where we were born. And so you see that if God had not been ever at my side, I could assuredly not have held out through those 6 long years that I spent in the Holy Land. When we reached Cyprus, the king was already there. I, who had not £1,000 worth of rents, had burdened myself when I went overseas with 9 other knights. And it so befell me that when I arrived at Cyprus after paying for my ship, I had only 70 tournois left, whereupon some of my knights sent me word that, if I could not procure money, they should leave me. But God, who never failed me, supplied me in this way, that the king sent for me and retained me and put £800 into my coffers, and then I had more money than I needed. Now that March had set in, by the king's orders, he and the barons and the other pilgrims ordered their ships to be reloaded with wines and victuals. So when all was duly in order, the king bade his barons follow him in their ships straight for Egypt. On the Saturday the king set sail, and all the other vessels likewise, which was a very fine sight to behold. For the whole sea, as far as the eye could reach, seemed to be covered with canvas from the sails of the ships, which were reckoned at 1,800 vessels, both large and small. On the Thursday after Pentecost, the king arrived at Damietta, and there found all the forces of the Sultan on the seashore. Very fine men to look at, for the Sultan's arms are of gold, and they glittered as they caught the sun. The noise that they made with their kettle drums and their Arabian horns was dreadful to hear. when I was disembarking his men, a knight belonging to Lord Erard of Brienne, named Planquet, attempted to get down from the big ship into his dinghy, but the dinghy, sheering off, he fell into the sea and was drowned. On returning to my ship, I put into my small boat a squire whom I knighted, named Lord Hugh of Vaucouleurs, together with two very valiant bachelors, one of whom was named Lord Villain of Verzy, and the other Lord William of Dunmartin. But these two had a fierce feud together, and no one was able to make peace between them, for in the Morea they had seized one another by the hair. But I made them forego their ill will and kiss each other, for I swore to them, by all that was holy, that we should not meet land while they were still at enmity. Then we started to go ashore, and came up to the dinghy astern of the king's big ship, and his men began to shout at me since I was getting ahead of them. But I paid no heed to them, and caused us to be landed opposite a big battalion of Turks, where there are about 6,000 men on horseback. As soon as they saw us touch, they came spurring towards us. When we saw them coming, we stuck the points of our shields in the sand and the staves of our lances in the sand, with the points towards them. And when they saw that they could come no further without being run through the belly, they faced about and fled away. The Saracens thrice sent word to the Sultan by carrier pigeons that the king had landed, but without getting any answer, for the Sultan was in his sickness. So they concluded that the Sultan must be dead and abandoned Damietta. The king sent on a knight as scout to learn the truth. The knight came back to the king and said that he had been inside the Sultan's houses and that it was quite true. Thereupon the king sent for the legate and all the prelates of the army, and they solemnly sang the Te Deum. Great favour the Lord showed us in delivering Damietta into our hands. Indeed, the Turks made a blunder in leaving Damietta without cutting the bridge of boats, which would have put us at a great inconvenience. And so the king and we all got on horseback, and we went and camped by Damietta. Now it happened that Lord Walter of Utrecht had armed himself at all points in his tent, and when he was mounted on his horse, with his shield around his neck and his helmet on his head, he lifted up the tent flaps and charged out against the Turks alone. Now it so chanced that before he ever reached the Turks, he fell, and his stallion passed over his body and rushed, laden with all his arms, into the ranks of the enemy. For most of the Saracens were mounted on mares, which attracted the horse. And those who saw it told us that four Saracens came by Lord Walter while he was lying on the ground, and as they passed by him, they struck him heavily with their clubs as he lay there. Then the Constable of France came to his rescue with some of the king's sergeants and carried him back by his arms to the pavilion. When he got there, he couldn't speak. Several of the army surgeons and doctors went to him, and, judging that there was no danger of death, they bled him in both arms. Quite late in the evening, though, Lord Albert of Narsy proposed to me that we should go and visit him, for we had not seen him, and he was a man of great renown and valour. He came into his tent, and his chamberlain met us, and bade us tread softly and not waken his master. We found him lying on rugs of miniver, and went very quietly up to him, and found him dead. When it was told to the king, he replied that he should be sorry to have 1,000 men like him, since they would disobey orders as he had done. Every night, the Saracens used to steal on foot into the camp, and kill people wherever they found them asleep. Thus it befell that they slew my lord of Courtenay's sentry, and left him lying on a table, and cut off his head, and carried it away with them. And this they did because the Sultan used to give a golden besant for every Christian's head. Whilst the king was tarrying, the great king of the Tartars sent messengers to him, greeting him courteously, and bearing word, amongst other things, that he was ready to help him conquer the Holy Land and deliver Jerusalem out of the hands of the Saracens. The king received them most graciously, and sent in reply messengers of his own, who remained away 2 years before they returned to him. How the King of France's messengers were received, I shall tell you, just as they told it themselves to the king, and in this story you will hear many strange things. But I will not relate this now, for it would break too much into the subject at hand. When the Count of Poitiers had arrived, the king summoned all the barons of the army to know which road he should take, whether to Alexandria or to Grand Cairo, And it so happened that the good Count, Peter of Brittany, and most of the barons agreed that the king ought to go and lay siege to Alexandria, for there was a good harbour by this town where the ships put in that bring provisions for the army. But the king's brother opposed this, and said that he would never consent to go anywhere except to Grand Cairo, because that was the capital of all Egypt, saying that if you wish to kill a snake, you must begin by crushing its head. And so the king neglected the opinion of the rest of his barons and followed his brother's advice. But it happened one night, whilst we were keeping night watch over the Tortoise Towers, that the Turks brought up against us an engine called a Peronel, which they had not done before, and filled the sling of the engine with Greek fire. On that good night, Lord Walter of Curiel, who was with me, saw this. He spoke to us as follows. Sirs, we are in the greatest peril that we have ever yet been in, for if they set fire to our turrets and shelters, we are lost and burnt, and if again we desert our defences which have been entrusted to us, we are disgraced, so none can deliver us from this peril save God alone. My opinion and advice therefore is that every time they hurl a fire at us, we go down on our elbows and knees and beseech our Lord to save us from this danger. And so soon as they flung the first shot, we went down on our elbows and knees as he had instructed us, and their first shot passed between the two turrets and lodged just in front of us where they had been raising the dam. Luckily our firemen were all ready to put out the fire, and the Saracens, not being able to aim straight at them, shot straight up into the clouds, so that the fire darts fell right on top of them. Indeed, this was the fashion of the Greek fire. It came on as broad in front as a vinegar cask, and the tail of fire that trailed behind it was as big as a great spear. And it made such a noise as it came that it sounded like the thunder of heaven. It looked like a dragon flying through the air. Such a bright light did it cast, that one could see all over the camp as though it were day, by reason of the great mass of fire and the brilliance of the light that it shed. Thrice that night they hurled the Greek fire at us, and four times shot it from the tourniquet crossbow. Then in the day they brought up their Peronel in broad daylight, which so far they had only done at night, and flung the Greek fire into our Tortoise Towers, and their engines had got the range very accurately. So it came to pass that two of our turrets were burnt, whereat the King of Sicily was so beside himself that he wanted to rush into the flames to put them out. But though he was furious, I and my knights praised God, for had we kept watch that night, we should have all been burnt up. I and my knights agreed that we should attack some Turks who were loading up their baggage to the left of the camp, and we charged upon them. Indeed, when I and my knights had got through the Saracens' camp, we found some 6,000 Turks, at a guess, who had abandoned their quarters and drawn off into the fields. When they saw us, they came charging down upon us, and whilst I was on my way back, the Turks pinned me down with their spears. My horse, feeling the weight, fell on his knees, and I passed over between his ears and picked myself up with my shield round my neck and my sword in my hand. Lord Erard of Sivery, God rest his soul, who was of my company, came up to me and said that we had best draw off to a ruined house and wait there until the king should come. And as we were going along on foot and horseback, a great horde of Turks broke upon us and bore me down and passed over me and snatched my shield from my neck. And when they were gone by, Lord Erard of Sivery came back to me and led me along till we reached the walls of the ruined house. But there the Turks attacked us on all sides. Part of them got into the ruins and thrust at us with their spears from above. Then my knights desired me to take hold of their horses' bridles, which I did, to prevent the horses from stampeding, and they warded off the Turks so vigorously that they were praised by all the champions of the army, both by those who saw the deed and those who only heard it. There, Lord Hugh of Scots was wounded with three spear wounds in his face, and Lord Frederick of Lupe was wounded with a spear between his shoulders, and the gash was so wide that the blood spurted out of his body as though through the tap of a cask. Lord Erard of Sivery got such a sword cut across his face that his nose hung down onto his lip. Then I bethought me of our Lord St. James. Fair Lord St. James, I prayed, help and save me in this need. No sooner had I made my prayer than Lord Erard said to me, Sir, I would go and fetch you help from the Count of Anjou, whom I see yonder in the fields. And I said to him, Sir Erard, methinks it would go greatly to your honour if you were to fetch us aid to save our lives, for truly your own life is in danger. I spoke the truth, for he died of that wound. He came to the Count of Anjou and begged him to come to the assistance of me and my knights. A rich man who was with him would have dissuaded him, but the Count of Anjou said he should do what my knight asked him, and he turned rein to come and help us, and several of the sergeants spurred on ahead, and when the Saracens saw them coming, they let us be. As I stood there on foot among my knights, all wounded as you have heard, the king came up with his whole battalion, with a great noise and din of trumpets and kettledrums, and halted on a raised path. Never did I see him so finely accoutred, for he towered head and shoulders above his followers, with a gilded helmet on his head and a German sword in his hand. He came to a halt in this place, and those champion knights of his battalion, whose names I told you, hurled themselves among the Turks, together with several brave knights of the king's battalion. And I would have you know that it was a very fine feat of arms, for there was no shooting with bows or crossbows, but the striking on both sides was all with clubs and swords, the Turks and our men being all mixed up together. One of my squires, who had fled with my banner but had come back, brought me a pony of mine, which I mounted and riding up to the king, placed myself at his side. And people say that that day's work would have been the end of us all if the king had not been there in person. In this battle, there were many people who made a very fine show, but ran away most disgracefully from the fight and fled in a panic over the little bridge of which I spoke, and not one of them could we persuade to make a stand beside us. I could very well tell you some of their names, but I shall refrain, because they are dead. After we had routed the Turks and driven them from their quarters, and during the time that the Saracens' camp was left empty by our people, the Bedouins, who were a very numerous race, broke into it. Not a single thing did they leave in the camp, but carried off everything that the Saracens had left behind. Yet I never heard it said that the Bedouins, who were subject to the Saracens, suffered any discredit for anything they had taken or stolen from them, for such is their custom and practice, ever to attack the losing side. Let us now proceed with our tale. At nightfall we returned, the king and we, from the perilous battle, and lodged in the place whence we had driven our enemies. My people, who had remained behind in the camp we had quitted, brought me a tent that the Templars had given me, and pitched it for me. I lay down in my bed, where I had great need to rest on account of the wounds I had gotten during the day, but chance served me otherwise. Before it was quite light, the cry arose in our camp, to arms! I roused my chamberlain, who was sleeping at my feet, and bade him to go and see what was the matter. He came back to me in great alarm, and said to me, Up, sir, up, for here are the Saracens, coming on foot and horseback, and they have routed the king's sergeants that were guarding the engines, and have driven them in among our lines. I got up and slipped a tunic over my shoulders, and clapped an iron cap on my head, and cried to our sergeants, By St. Nicholas, I shall not stay here. My knights joined me, all wounded as they were, and we drove the Saracen sergeants out from among the engines and back onto a large squadron of mounted Turks who were close to the engines we had captured. I sent to the king asking for help, for neither I nor my knights were able to put on hauberks because of the wounds we had received, and the king sent us my lord Walter of Châtillon, who placed himself in front, between us and the Turks. Out of this company of mounted Turks, 8 of their captains had alighted, all remarkably well armed, and had made a barricade of hewn stones so that our crossbowmen might not wound them. And these 8 Saracens kept shooting flights of arrows into our camp and wounded several of our men and horses. So I and my knights laid our heads together and agreed that when night came, we would carry away the stones with which they were barricaded. But a priest of mine, whose name was Lord John of Voysey, had made up his own mind and was less patient. He set off from the camp all by himself in the direction of the Saracens. clad in his tunic with his iron cap on his head and his spear trailing under his arm, point downwards so that the Saracens might not catch sight of it. So when he got close to the Saracens, who, seeing him all alone, never troubled their heads about him, he caught his spear up under his arm and charged on them. Not one of the eight made any attempt at defence, but they all turned and fled. From that time forth, my priest was a noted man throughout the army, and they used to point him out to one another and say, "There goes my Lord of Joinville's priest, who routed the eight Saracens." On the eve of Shrove Tuesday, I had witnessed a marvel that I will relate to you. For on that same day, we laid in the earth Lord Hugh of Landricourt, who carried his banner in my company. There, as he laid upon the bier in my chapel, there were six of my knights lolling upon some sacks of barley. Because they were talking noisily in my chapel and disturbing the priest, I went up to them and bade them be quiet, telling them that it was a disgraceful thing for knights and gentlemen to talk whilst Mass was being sung. But thereupon, they began to laugh in my face, and told me, laughing, that they would have the remarrying of his wife. And I rated them, and I told them that such words were neither right nor seemly, and that they had quickly forgotten their comrade. And thus did God take vengeance on them. That on the morrow was the great battle of Shrove Tuesday, wherein they were either slain or wounded to death, so that their wives had to be remarried, all six of them. But after the battles already narrated, the army's troubles began in earnest. For, at the end of 9 days, the bodies of our men whom they had slain rose to the surface of the water. They say it was because their galls had rotted and came floating down as far as the bridge that joined the two camps and could not get by because the bridge was flush with the water. A great mass of them there was, so that the stream was choked with corpses from one bank to the other, and they reached a short stone's throw up the river. The king had hired 100 common labourers who were busied at it for quite a week. The bodies of the Saracens, which were circumcised, they flung over to the other side of the bridge and let them drift down the river. The Christians, however, were laid all together in great trenches. I saw the Count of Artois' chamberlains there and many others seeking their friends among the dead, but I never heard of anyone being recognised. We ate no fish in the camp all Lent, save mud eels, and the eels, being greedy fish, used to feed on the dead bodies. And from this misfortune, together with the unhealthiness of the country, where there never falls a drop of rain, we were stricken with the camp sickness, which was such that the flesh of our limbs all shriveled up, and the skin on our legs became all blotched with black, mouldy patches, like an old jackboot, and proud flesh came upon the gums of those who had the sickness, and none escaped from this sickness, save through the jaws of death. The signal was this: when the nose began to bleed, then death was at hand. A fortnight later, the Turks, intending to starve us out, took several of their galleys and had them dragged overland to the river, and these galleys caused a famine, for none of our side dared come from Damietta to bring us provisions upstream because of their galleys. From this cause, there arose such a dearth in the camp that by the time Easter had come, an ox was worth in the camp 80 pounds, a sheep 30 pounds, a pig 30 pounds, an egg 12 pence, and a hogshead of wine 10 pounds. The sickness began to increase, and so much dead flesh came upon the gums of our people that the barbers were obliged to remove it to enable them to chew their food and to swallow. A most piteous thing it was to hear through the camp the screams of the people from whom they were cutting the dead flesh, for they screamed just like women labouring with child. Owing to the wounds that I got on Shrove Tuesday, the camp sickness seized me in my mouth and legs, together with a double tertian fever and such a violent rheum in my head, and the rheum streamed out of my head through my nostrils, and by reason of these maladies, I took to my bed in mid-Lent. Now it so chanced that my priest was sitting by my bedside in my pavilion, and he had the same malady that I had, and it came to pass that in the midst of performing the sacrament, he fainted. When I saw him tottering, I leapt from my bed with my coat on, but all barefoot, and clasped him in my arms, and bade him finish his sacrament fairly and forthwith, telling him I would not leave go of him until he should have completed it. He pulled himself together and performed the sacrament, and sang his mass all through, and never sang service again. After these events, the king's council and the sultan's council fixed a day to make terms, and the terms of the agreement were these. The Damietta was to be restored to the sultan, and the sultan was to restore to the king the kingdom of Jerusalem. But when the king saw that he should die, he and his people, if they stayed in that place any longer, he gave his orders and made all ready for removing thence at nightfall on the evening of Tuesday after the octave of Easter and returning to Damietta. And so on Tuesday we went on board on rising from dinner with two knights whom I had left of my household, and when the time came that it began to grow dark, I told my sailors to weigh anchor and let us drift downstream. But as we went to Damietta, the king was captured. At the same time that the men on land were captured, we suffered the same disaster, for we were taken on the water. The mounted Saracens on the bank shot arrows at us because we would not come to them. My people had dressed me in a jousting hauberk, which I put on so that the arrows which fell into our vessel should not wound me. At this point, those of my people who were on the prow of the boat facing downstream cried out to me, "Sir, sir, your sailors are trying to run you ashore because the Saracens are threatening them." As feeble as I was, I made them raise me by my arms and drew my sword on the sailors and told them that I would murder them if they ran me ashore. It was not long before we saw four of the Sultan's galleys approaching with a full 1,000 men in them. Thereupon, I called my knights and my men and asked them what they wished us to do, whether to surrender to the Sultan's galleys or to surrender to those on land. We all agreed that we would rather surrender to the Sultan's galleys because they would keep us together than surrender to those on land who would scatter us and sell us to the Bedouins. But then said a sailor of mine, a native of Doulouvan, "Sir, I am not of this opinion." I asked him what his opinion was, and he said to me, "My opinion is that we should all let ourselves be killed, and then we shall all go to heaven." We did not listen to him. When I saw that we were bound to be taken, I took my cash box and my jewels and threw them into the river, and my relics as well. Then said one of my sailors to me, "Sir, unless you say that you are the king's cousin, they will kill you and us along with you." I told him that for my part he might say what he liked. But as the first galley was bearing down on us to ram us on the beam, they heard what the sailor said, and they cast anchor alongside our vessel. After that they bore me down and leapt upon my body to cut my throat, for each would have prided himself on being the one to kill me. But one Saracen held his arms around me all the time and kept calling out, "The king's cousin." And then, by reason of the fear I was in and the sickness as well, I began to tremble very violently. Then I asked for something to drink, and they brought me water in a jar, but I had no sooner taken it into my mouth to swallow it than it poured out again through my nostrils. When I saw this, I sent for my people and told them I was as good as dead, for I had the tumor in my throat. They asked me how I knew it, and presently they saw that the water poured from my throat and nostrils, and they began to weep. When the Saracen knights who were there saw my followers weeping, they asked the Saracens who had saved us why they wept. He replied that he understood me to have a tumor in my throat, so that there was no hope for me. But thereupon one of the Saracen knights told him who had protected us to bid us be of good cheer, for that he would give me something to drink which would cure me within 2 days. And so he did. On the following Sunday, the Emir made me and all the other prisoners who had been taken on the water land on the riverbank. Whilst they were dragging my good priest, Lord John, out of the hold of the galley, he fainted, and they killed him and threw him into the river. I told them through my Saracen that methought it was ill done, inasmuch as it was contrary to the teachings of Saladin, who said that one ought not to slay any man who has once tasted our bread and salt. They replied that they were not to be accounted men, who were good for nothing, being disabled by disease. On the Thursday before Ascension Day, we came to the place where the rest house was pitched, and they brought the king ashore into a pavilion near it. The Sultan had arranged that on the Saturday before Ascension, Damietta should be delivered up to him, and he should deliver up the king. But emirs, whom the Sultan had dismissed from his council in order to fill their places with his own followers whom he had brought from foreign parts, took counsel together, and a certain wise old Saracen told us as follows. "Sirs, you see the shame and disgrace which the Sultan has put upon us in removing us from the dignity to which his father had raised us." So the emirs hurled Greek fire at him and set light to his tower. The tower kindled rapidly. Indeed, I never saw such a splendid fire, nor such a pillar of flame. Seeing this, the Sultan hastily descended, and as the Sultan rushed on his way to the river, one of the emirs thrust him with a spear between the ribs, and the Sultan fled into the river, trailing the spear, and they swam right in after him, and killed him in the stream, not far from our galley, where we were. One of the Saracens ripped him open with his sword and tore his heart out of his body, and then went straight to the king with his hand all bloody, and said to him, "What will you give me, if I have slain your enemy, who would have been the death of thee, had he lived?" And the king answered him, "Never a word." Indeed, there came full 30 of them to our galley, with their naked swords in their hands and their Danish axes. I asked Lord Baldwin of Ibelin, who knew Arabic well, what these fellows were saying, and he answered that they were saying they had come to cut off our heads. There were a whole lot of people confessing themselves to a brother of the Trinity who belonged to Count William of Flanders, but for my part, I could recall never a sin that I had committed, only I reflected that the more I resisted and the more I tried to avoid the stroke, the worse it would be for me. So I crossed myself and knelt down at the feet of a fellow who was carrying a Danish axe. Sir Guy of Ibelin, the Constable of Cyprus, knelt down beside me and confessed himself to me, but when I rose up afterwards, I recollected not a thing that he had said. They made us leave the place where we were and shut us up in the hold of the galley, and many of our people thought that they had done so because they were unwilling to attack us in a body and preferred to dispatch us one by one. There we lay all night in this sorry plight, and so closely packed that my feet were touching the good Count Peter of Brittany's face, and his were touching mine. Eventually, though, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, an aged man, 80 years old, had procured a safe conduct from the Saracens and had come to the king to assist him in obtaining liberty. And after the terms had been agreed and sworn to by the king and the emirs, it was agreed that they should set us free on Ascension Day. But the king and us, whom they ought to have set free at sunrise, they kept us until sunset, and we had nothing to eat the whole time, nor the emirs either, for they were disputing among themselves the whole day. One emir, speaking on behalf of his party, said, "Sirs, if you will listen to me, we should kill the king, and these rich men here, and then, for 40 years to come, we shall be free from anxiety, for their children are young." But another Saracen, who was a native of Morocco, opposed this. "If we kill the king after having killed the Sultan, it will be said that the Egyptians are the wickedest and most treacherous race on earth." Our death was almost agreed upon, so much so that an emir who was hostile to us, thinking that we were all to be put to death, came down to the riverbank and began shouting in Arabic to those in charge of the galleys, and took off his turban and signalled to them with it. We then gave ourselves all up for lost, and many tears were shed. However, as it pleased God, who does not forget his own, it was decided about the time of sunset that we were finally to be set free. We besought them to let us depart, but they replied that they would not do so until we should have eaten, for it would be a disgrace to the emirs, they said, if you were to leave our prisons hungry. The food that they gave us was cheese fritters, cooked in the sun to prevent maggots getting into them, and eggs hard-boiled for 4 or 5 days, and in our honour they had been painted outside with various colours. We were put ashore and went to meet the king, whom they were bringing down from the pavilion on the bank where they had kept him, and about 20,000 Saracens, girt with swords, were following him on foot. Whilst he was staying thus in Acre, the king sent for his brothers, the Count of Flanders and the other rich men one Sunday, and spoke to them as follows. "Sirs, my lady mother the queen has sent that I should go back to France. My kingdom is in great danger, because I have no peace nor truce with the King of England. The men of this country, with whom I have talked, tell me that if I go, this country is lost. Therefore I beg you," said he, "to think it over. And since the matter is a weighty one, I grant you a respite of a week from now, before you give your answer as to what you think is best." And so on the next Sunday we came again before the king, and then the king asked his brothers and the other barons and the Count of Flanders what advice they meant to give him, to go or to stay. The legate said to me that he did not see how the king could possibly remain, and entreated me very particularly to share his ship. I answered him that it was out of my power to do so, for that I possessed nothing, as he knew, having lost everything in the water when I was captured. And I answered him that I thought the king should stay. The legate said to me angrily, "How's it possible for the king to hold the field with so few men as he had?" I too replied in anger, for it seemed to me his words were meant as a personal attack. "Well, sir, I will tell you how, since you wish it. It is said, sir, whether true or not, I do not know, that the king has yet to spend any of his own money, only the money of the clergy. Now let the king bring some of his own money into use, and let him send and raise knights in the Maria and beyond the seas." No sooner had we left the place than I was attacked on all sides. "Well, Sir de Joinville, the king must be mad if he listens to you, contrary to the whole council of the Kingdom of France." As soon as the tables were laid, I seated myself beside the king at the board, in the place where he always made me sit when his brothers were not there. But not a word did he speak to me all the time that the meal lasted, which was not his wont, for he always took some notice of me at table, and truly I thought that he was angry with me, because I'd said that he'd not spent any of his own money, whereas he spent it generously. And so as I was standing there, the king came and leant over my shoulder and placed both his hands upon my head. And I thought it was Lord Philip, who had plagued me enough that day because of the advice I'd given the king, and I said, "Leave me in peace, Lord Philip." By mishap, as I jerked my head, the king's hand slipped down over my face, and I recognized the king by an emerald that he wore on his finger. And so he said to me, "Keep still, for I wish to ask you how you could make so bold a young man like you as to venture to advise me to stay here, in opposition to all the great men and wise men of France, who advise me to go away. Do you mean," said he, "that I should be doing a wrong thing if I left? So help me God, yes, sir," quoth I. "If I stay, will you stay?" And I told him, "Yes, by some means, either at my own charge or that of someone else." The announcement that the king made of remaining was made on the feast of St. John. Days later, the king said loudly, as though in anger, "Sirs, it is already a month since my staying here was made known, and as yet I have no tidings that you have retained me any knights." "Sir, we cannot help it, for everyone sets such a high price on himself, because they want to go home, that we should not dare to give them what they ask." "And who," says the king, "is the cheapest they can get?" "Why, sir," said they, "John de Joinville, but we should not dare to give him what he asks." I was in the king's room and heard these words. Then said the king, "Call the seneschal hither." So I went to him, and he made me sit down, and spoke thus to me, "Seneschal, you know that I have loved you well, and now my people tell me that they find you a hard bargainer. How is this?" "Sir," said I cannot help it, for, as you know, I was taken prisoner on the water, and not a single thing was left me, but I lost all I had." He asked me how much I was asking, and I said that I was asking for £2,000 till Easter, for the 2/3 of the year. "Now tell me," said he, "have you come to terms with any knights?" And I said, "Yes, with Lord Peter of Pont-Moulin, he and two other knights, who cost each £400 to Easter." He reckoned it up on his fingers. "That makes," said he, £1,200 that your new knights will cost." "Well then, consider, sir," said I, "whether I shall not want quite £800 to mount and arm myself and to feed my knights, for you do not want us to eat in your house." Then said the king to his followers, "Really, I do not see anything excessive in this. I shall retain you," he said to me. Whilst the king was fortifying Caesarea, the messengers from the Tartars returned. They'd put in at the port of Antioch, and from Antioch to the great Tartar king, they found it a full year's journey, riding 10 leagues every day. They found all the land subject to the Tartars, and many cities which they had destroyed, and great piles of dead men's bones. They inquired how they had arrived at such a height of power, whereby so many men were dead and overthrown, and the manner of it was as they related to the king. The Tartars, they said, had their origin in a great sandy plain, where nothing good grew. This plain began at certain marvellous great rocks that lie at the end of the world towards the east. And they said that it was there that the race of Gog and Magog were confined, who are to come at the end of the world, when Antichrist shall come to destroy it. In this plain dwelt the race of the Tartars. And when the great king of the Tartars had received the messengers and the gifts, they gave the king's messengers letters in return from their great king, which ran as follows. A good thing is peace, for in a land of peace, those that go on 4 feet eat the grass of the field in peace, and they that go on 2 till the earth. This is warning unto thee, for you cannot obtain peace except through us. For kings such and such and such and such, they named many, all of them have we put to the sword. Therefore, we bid thee send us so much of thy gold and thy silver each year, that you may keep our friendship. And if you do not, then we will destroy thee and thy people, as we have done to those whom we have named. And so the king was very sorry that he'd ever sent messengers to them. We found that the king in person had seen to the burials of the bodies of the Christians whom the Saracens had killed, and he himself with his own hands carried the decayed and stinking bodies to lay them in the graves, and yet never held his nose, though the others held theirs. He had workmen fetched from all parts and set to work again to fortify the city with high walls and great towers. And when we reached the camp, we found that he had marked the sites in person where our quarters were to be. My quarters he had chosen alongside those of the Count of U, because he knew that the Count of U liked my company. But I will tell you of the tricks the Count of U used to play on us. I built a hut where I used to take my meals, I and my knights, lighted through the doorway. Now the doorway gave onto the Count of U's quarters, and he, who was very ingenious, made a little machine to throw things into it, and used to watch when we went to table and set up his machine in a line with our table and break our jugs and glasses. I had a stock of hens, and somebody or other had given him a young she-bear, which he let in among my fowls and killed a dozen of them before anyone could get to the spot, while the woman in charge of them was flapping her skirts at the bear. Here I will tell you how I ordered and managed my affairs during the 4 years that I spent abroad, after the king's brothers went away. I had 2 chaplains with me, who said my hours before me. One of them sang me my mass at daybreak, and the other waited until my knights and the knights of my troop were risen. When I heard my mass, I went off to the king. When the king wished to go riding, I accompanied him. Sometimes it would happen that messengers would arrive for him, so that we had to transact business all the morning. My bed was so arranged in my tent that no one could ever enter without seeing me lying in it, and this I did to avoid all scandal about women. When the feast of St. Remy drew near, I had my pig yard stocked with porkers and my sheep run with wethers, and brought in a supply of flour and wine to serve the household through the winter. This I did because the price of goods went up in winter because of the sea, which is more treacherous in winter than in summer. I used to buy about 100 casks of wine, and always had the best drunk first, and the servants' wine I always had mixed with water, and less water with the wine for the squires. At my own table, they used to serve up to my knights a large jug of wine and a large jug of water, and they mixed them as they chose. I will tell you of a knight who was caught in a house of ill fame. He was offered, according to the custom of the country, an alternative, either to be led by a rope through the camp, stripped to his shirt, or to forfeit his horse and armour and be turned out of the army. So he left his horse and armour to the king and quitted the camp. And I went and begged the king to grant me the horse for a poor gentleman that was in the army. The king replied that it was an unreasonable request, for that the horse was still worth from 80 to £100, which was no small sum. Whilst the king was fortifying the city, there came merchants to the camp, who told us and related how the king of the Tartars had taken the city of Baghdad with the Saracen Pope, who was lord of the town and whom they called the Caliph of Baghdad. In order to cloak his treachery and throw on the Caliph the blame of the town's capture, he had the Caliph seized and put into an iron cage, and had him starved as far as one could starve a man without killing him, and then sent to ask him whether he was hungry. The Caliph said, "Yes, and no wonder." Then the Tartar king caused a great charger of gold to be brought to him, laden with jewels and precious stones, and said to him, "Dost thou know these jewels?" And the Caliph said, "Yes, they were mine." Then he asked him if he was very fond of them. He answered, "Yes, since thou dost like them so well," said the Tartar king, "come, take whichever thou wouldst and eat." The Caliph answered that it was impossible, inasmuch as they were not food for eating. Then said the king of the Tartars to him, "Now mayest thou see in this bowl where thy defense lay, for if you had parted with some of thy golden treasure, it would have been your defense against us, if you had but spent it, whereas now it fails thee at thy greatest need." When King Louis left the city of Sajetta, which he had secured with high walls and great towers, and with great moats puddled inside and out, the patriarch and the barons of the country came to him and addressed him as follows. "Sir, you have fortified the cities of Sajetta and of Caesarea, and the town of Jaffa, very greatly to the benefit of the Holy Land. Moreover, you have greatly strengthened the city of Acre by the walls and the towers that you have built there. Sir, we have considered among ourselves, and perceive that your longer stay can be of no benefit to the kingdom of Jerusalem. Wherefore we approve and advise that you cross over to France after this Easter next." And so, following the advice of the patriarch and the barons, the king left. All Lent, the king busied himself fitting out his ships to return to France. They were made ready by the vigil of St. Mark after Easter, on which day the king and queen went aboard their ship, and we had favourable wind for our departure. On St. Mark's Day, the king told me that he was born on that day, and I replied that he might truly add that he was born again, seeing from what a land of danger he was escaping. And so on the feast of St. Bartholomew, passed away from this world, Louis, a good king, in the year of the incarnation of our Lord, the year of grace, 1270. And his bones were preserved in a casket and buried at Saint Denis in France, where he had chosen his burying place. Yet there is still something that I want to tell you about our holy king, which is to his honour. It is this. In a dream, methought I saw him in front of my chapel at Joinville, and methought he was wondrous joyous and light-hearted. And I myself was very happy in seeing him at my castle, and I said to him, "Sir, when you leave this place, I will lodge you in a house of mine, which stands in one of my towns called Chevillon." And he answered me laughing, and said, "By my faith, Sir de Joinville, I'm in no such hurry to leave this place." I give all men to know that I have herein set down a great part of the deeds of this, our holy king, by me seen and heard. This I mention in order that those who shall hear this book may firmly believe in what the book says, which I have truly seen and heard. And this was written in the year of grace 1309, in the month of October. You've been watching Voices of the Past. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.